Yeah. Oh.
That's you.
Okay.
Testing, testing.
Yeah, that's working.
Great.
So theoretically,
the recorder's on. I'm going to pause it. You click again, you can just close it. It won't, or you just keep it open.
That helps.
Yeah,
I think we have some new faces who weren't able to join us for our first feedback conference. So just to introduce you guys, this year, Lanrae and I put together a pediatric public health and advocacy curriculum for everyone. It's going to be 5 lectures throughout the year. This is our second one. And just so you all know, the objectives are up here, but basically we want to talk about public health and advocacy and get you guys involved and interested in advocacy, their ultimate goal. This does constitute credit for the chat pathways. That's something that you're interested in. We got it up on Resident Book in a small fee. You can find it under like the chat pathway, and the PowerPoints are going to be up from each session, as well as resources to learn more, do more, and get involved are also up. So if you want to do that, get involved, you can talk to Dr. Dooley. If you miss any of the lectures, our goal is to have the recorded lectures up for you on Resident Book as well. So we're going to start each of these sessions with what's going on in the news. Welcome back, Dan. So the biggest event that hopefully most people here have heard about is that Trump has an executive order to end the APA subsidies. Why this is important: these are the subsidies that have allowed people to buy insurance on the marketplaces at a reduced rate for their premiums. And if these subsidies from the federal government go away, those marketplace premiums are going to go up and people are going to be less able to afford their insurance. So for right now, insurers can start backing out of their federal contracts as early as 2018. And he, according to the president, these federal subsidies are a way that the government is propping up insurance companies, excuse me. The other caveat to that is that the order also removed consumer protections for association health plans, which means that these are health plans that are under small businesses that kind of exempt them from certain rules and regulations under the ACA. But by removing the consumer protection, people basically can start buying into what some would consider bad plans or plans that don't have as much coverage. And there was also under the ACA a policy for you to be able to buy like a disaster plan for short-term coverage for 3 months, and they're expanding that to be a year long. So people are concerned that young people, such as ourselves, would buy into these disaster plans for a year and then remove themselves from the market, from the insurance market where we need to be, because we as wealthy people need to be helping pay into the insurance that we're not using. Finally, employers are able to use pre-tax dollars for health reimbursement arrangements. It's a way for employers to be able to pay for medical expenses outside of paying for insurance, which is kind of complicated, and I don't think anyone really understands how that would ever work. So anyway, this happened, then this happened. So we had Senator Lamar from Tennessee, he's a Republican, and Patty Murray from Washington. They co-authored a bill that, and bipartisan support, this is what we want to see, co-authored a bill to continue the federal subsidies for another 2 years. Right now it has support of 48 Democrats and 12 Republicans, so it has a majority of support in the Senate. This was the initial tagline when it came from the Washington Post: "Key senators reach bipartisan health care subsidy deal, and Trump expresses support." Literally the next day, this was it: Trump pulled back from Senate deal to fund health subsidies. So we have no idea exactly where the president is on this, and we'll find out. In case you missed this, 60 Minutes in the Washington Post had a huge expose about a week ago that basically lobbyists on behalf of drug distributors had encouraged Congress to pass a law that hampered the DEA's ability to freeze shipments of narcotics to pharmacies. It's a long story, obviously, but throughout this opioid crisis, the DEA has found that the people who are in charge of drug distribution have been shipping grossly exaggerating quantities of opioids to very small pharmacies, and it didn't make sense. Like, towns of 3,000 were getting just exorbitantly high numbers of pills. They were trying to freeze these shipments, which the narcotics industry did not want them freezing because that hampers their income. And they got mad, and so they funded a bill that prevented the DEA from freezing those shipments, saying it was the government impeding people getting the medications they needed. Overall, the numbers are pretty impressive. So $1.5 million went to 23 lawmakers who sponsored or co-sponsored the bill directly from the lobbyists of the drug manufacturers, and $102 million was spent overall in lobbying on behalf of this bill. The bill passed with a unanimous vote in Congress and the Senate when Obama was president and was signed by President Obama. Obama's administration isn't saying very much about it right now. They're basically saying it didn't have strong opposition from anyone in the House or Congress. It didn't have strong opposition from the DEA. The head of the DEA at the time who was trying to fight this bill, who's this guy, was fired. In relation to the opioid crisis, we're now seeing an outbreak of hepatitis C, so just so you guys are aware. There have been reports that the cases have tripled nationwide, and the CDC is estimating that 34,000 people contracted the disease in 2015. We also know better on CHIP funding than where we were when we last talked. So when we spoke together last time, we were hoping that a CHIP bill would be passed by the 27th. Unfortunately, it didn't. There is a bill that's been written. They haven't been voting on it. They haven't been deciding what to do on it. And in the meantime, this is just a really interesting graph from the Kaiser Foundation showing when places are set to run out of CHIP funding. But not looking good for anyone in this October to December. We are in October right now, so a handful of states are affected now. Virginia has already started dismantling their CHIP program in anticipation of not getting funding. And then, to end on that happy note, the Rohingya refugee crisis. I didn't go over this last time, and that was my mistake, because I don't know that people are talking about this enough. The Rohingya are a group of minorities who live in Myanmar. They are Muslim and a predominantly Buddhist nation, and in response to a few bombings or attacks on military stations, the Myanmar army has been killing, raping, and people and burning villages and causing a huge refugee crisis. People are streaming into Bangladesh. There are over 500,000 people in refugee camps there. There are a bunch of people from Myanmar who are Rohingya who can't get out either, who are entirely surrounded right now. And the latest I read is that there are starting to be diarrheal outbreaks, and they're really worried about a cholera epidemic starting in the refugee camps in Bangladesh. In case you don't know where Myanmar is located, it is right here. So predominantly people are moving into Bangladesh right now. They're all camping really along the border because there's opposition from the Bangladesh government. Lastly, this is a bill I'm hoping to sometimes let you guys know what's going on the Hill. This Reach Every Mother and Child Act of 2017 has support from the American Academy of Pediatrics. You can write to your legislation representatives and tell them to support it as well. It is a bill that is basically trying to prevent maternal mortality and child death in early ages, trying to establish goals and people are responsible for it. It was already passed in the Senate. It is now sitting in the House waiting to be passed. So with that, I'm going to hand it over to Dr. Fox. He's going to talk to us about refugee and immigrant health in the current crisis for refugees and immigrants in our country.
Thank you.
Now, I will hope it's the microphone. Yeah, the microphone.
So I'm hoping today, obviously this is a huge topic, and we can spend the next 3 days and not cover half of what we need to cover. So I was hoping to sort of scale it down and hopefully talk a little bit more about how these issues affect us here on the local level, and then providing avenues or ways that you guys can sort of take a deeper dive, if you will, if you want, and just giving you some resources for doing that. This is, as most of us get up here on Thursday, I'd love this to be a conversation with Leland's Rock, right? And ask questions, give your points. The slides are mainly here as a way to like give some structure to our conversation, but you know, I'm not married to the idea that we have to sort of cover everything that's on there. We just sort of see where this discussion in the room takes us. The slides are also here in case you want to go back and look at them later, mainly. So this is here more for historical perspective. This is a clinic in Mexico, one of the Doctors Without Borders clinics that are sort of as stations along the migration route in Mexico. That's what that picture is. But I was just going to read a quote from John F. Kennedy's book that was put together posthumously in the 60s. But the famous words of Emma Lazarus on the pedestal of the Statue of Liberty read, "Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses, yearning to breathe free." Until 1921, this was an accurate picture of our society. Under present law, it would be more appropriate to add, as long as they come from Northern Europe, are not too tired, or too poor, or slightly ill, never stole a loaf of bread, never joined any questionable organization, and can document their activities for the past 2 years. I just think it's interesting because this was like 50 years ago, right? And so like, you can still sort of say a lot of this is obviously still very much at play. So these are our learning objectives. I think Amanda covered some learning objectives. And so the first thing I want to do is just to give us a flavor for, I think a lot of us know what happens on our end, right? So we're taking care of kids here at the hospital, in our clinics, in our city, in our community centers. I want to give you a little bit of brief, which is why I'm picking this video again. I think it's pretty brief, but it gives you a little bit of a sense for what happens with kids and their families are on the way here.
Everyone,
¿qué pasó con tu mamá? La mataron. Pero fui a salir y me puse a vivir con ella. Ya que fue que aquí mi amigo enfermo me dijo que si me quería vivir con él, pues Estados Unidos.
Yo tengo 15 años de vivir en la calle. Yo fui drogadito. Me empecé a decir, si mi vida no será así, mejor busco otra. Busco otra que me pueda yo salir de esto.
México es el paso de la muerte para ustedes. El tren puede ser tu mejor amigo porque te va a ayudar a viajar. Pero puede ser tu peor enemigo, te puede matar. Estados Unidos no es el paso de la muerte. Estados Unidos es la muerte misma. En la frontera, en el día, hay temperaturas de 50 hasta 65 grados. Y esta garrafa no te va a aguantar. Y para 3 días, en camino. Está comprobadísimo que de cada 100 en la frontera, mueren de entre 10 a más de 20. Aquí a lo mejor muchos van a morir. Ahora, hermanos, ¿quién de aquí quisiera realmente ir a Estados Unidos? Levante la mano.
Estoy haciendo eso porque tengo casi 3 años de no ver a mi mamá y estoy estar unida con ella, con mi editora.
Cuéntame tú, ¿a quién vas a ir a buscar?
A mi papá, que fue porque necesitábamos dinero y se fue y yo lo estaba mandando.
¿Cómo te imaginas que eso pasa?
Me imagino que estábamos allá jugando con la nieve.
¿Te ha
contado tu mamá, querida?
¿Te ha
sentido? Sí. ¿Y
cómo
te imaginas? ¿Qué te imaginas? Se puede leer un libro.
So the, and there are many, many different documentaries and books and articles and, that have been done and really sort of highlight the sort of pre-migration experience of what these kids and families are going through in their countries and areas of origin, and then sort of migration concerns, and then post-migration, right? So we sort of divide the migration experience into those three sort of time periods because each of them poses challenges to the kids and families. And I wanted to just start by putting together a little bit of a conversation. Before we talk about this, I think it helps to talk a little bit about like just some definitions. What is a refugee and what is an immigrant? And sort of potentially are there differences or not? People use those words a lot interchangeably. This is a theme from, if anybody's heard about it, Ai Weiwei's documentary just came out. There's just a scene from that movie, and it's kind of a piece of where I saw it over the weekend. So a refugee is someone who has been forced to flee his or her country because of persecution, war, or violence. And a refugee has a well-founded fear of persecution for reasons of race, religion, nationality, political opinion, or membership in a particular social group. And most likely cannot return home or are afraid to do so. And so the definition that's used internationally for refugee implies that there is one of these reasons that drove folks to leave their country of origin and that they feel like they would be threatened or endangered to return. Right? And so an immigrant or migrant chooses to move not because of a direct threat of persecution or death, but mainly to improve their lives by finding work or in some cases for education, family reunion, or other reasons. Ultimately, these individuals, in theory, could go back to their country of origin without facing some sort of danger or immediate threat to themselves. And certainly, these two definitions get very blurry, right? So there, you could be a refugee by definition, but also be a migrant by refugee. You can face persecution and threat and danger to your life and health, and at the same time also want to move somewhere for better opportunity, right? So these two, in a lot of ways, those two sentiments are not mutually exclusive, but we use these terms very differently. And it has a lot of meaning at the judicial level. So if you're in a court and you basically are trying to justify your presence here in the U.S. and your justification for staying here, then obviously you need to, quote-unquote, qualify as a refugee in order to do that. The migrants, by and large, if they're here illegally, don't have a legal standing to stay in the United States, and those are the folks that face deportation, right? And so that's why these definitions matter. A lot of folks use the term immigrants or migrants for a lot of our Central American families and children that are coming to the United States and don't have legal documents to be here. There's lots of reasons why that's not true. They are facing a lot of danger, a lot of violence back home, and a lot of them feel very threatened to go back. And so a lot of international agencies and groups that work with these kids and families are making very strong arguments on an advocacy level to sort of change the term we're using that are applied to children and families in those situations. EAP has some pretty clear opinions on what we should be doing to take care of these kids. This was a 2013 policy statement that came out, and then this was this year about the detention of immigrant children, specifically addressing a lot of the unaccompanied minors that are arriving mostly from Central America, given our proximity to the interesting thing is, I always find this interesting. So in 2013, they came out with this and replaced the statement from 2005, and the 2005 statement was around the care of immigrant homeless and refugee children. I always find it interesting that those kids were all lumped together, I don't think. So in 2013, they decided to make a statement around these kids, and then they have a separate statement around the concerns we should have in taking care of children and families who are homeless. So my 14-year-old said to me about the cheesy, I know how much you love this part, statement. However, so I'm going to make you guys talk to each other a little bit. We're going to spend a couple minutes doing this. I want you, just the person next to you, find a person next to you, think of a recent patient encounter with a refugee or immigrant family, right? And I know we have these encounters all the time. What did you like about the encounter? Can you identify any patient, family, friends? What did you not like about the encounter? And then, you know, and be honest, like, you know, like, for example, we all hate graduate experience, like, right? Like, that's a given, right? Like, so that's a barrier, right? So what barriers of care can you identify? And then what are the more common countries of origin as far as the kids you're seeing, right? And then think about what factors drive migration for these groups. So if we spend maybe like a minute on each of these, and then we'll just write down some of your thoughts, all right? So I'll give you about 4 minutes.
Yeah. Can you go back to the last slide?
There's children who
live. Children that live. So there are a number, just like you pointed out, for in the Rohingya, they're fleeing Myanmar and they're living literally along the border. Many of those kids end up living in these huge camps.
Okay.
And they're almost stateless, to be honest, because most of the time they haven't been accepted by the side that they're trying to get to. And then, for example, in Europe, along several borders in the last couple of years, it's essentially built up defenses with barbed wire and huge parts along the sea to avoid that a lot of the Middle Eastern and African refugees cross Turkey to Germany and have to get there in several countries before to get to Germany and set up these essentially walls. And now you have these huge camps for the children living in those scenarios. And then you also have in certain parts of the world where borders are much more fluid and people sort of go back and forth quite a bit. But a lot of times those kids, those families, those individuals aren't really trained by anyone, so they're not necessarily getting any tests before the social services come out.
And in the U.S., what many people talk about border kids along the U.S.-Mexico border, where there's a lot of potential, where some borders are very fluid, some may have some walls, but there are families that may go back and forth, but a lot of the kids, we have colleagues who practice in Texas right on the border, so they're seeing a lot of kids who are coming across unaccompanied and being so close to another country, Mexico, which may not be their country of origin, actually. It brings a lot of complexities of where they go, if they do get to see it. A little bit different from the immigrant child we might see here in D.C., living on the border with the security and all that.
And specifically about the U.S.
on the phone listening in, do you mind muting your line?
Yeah.
was in Argentina looking up stuff, and it's like, I wish we could be like Venezuela.
Yeah,
it was like,
it is such a common perception, right? And it's an interesting one for gazillion different reasons, right? But it's such a
I think another sign is that you want a lot of
anybody else, or
I'm gonna put out a strength and a barrier. I think this one goes in between, but I find that a lot of the things I take care of for Latino have a trust, and generally a more inherent trust in the medical system, and a tendency to listen to the physician and to do the best they can in terms of following our instructions. The reason that I find it to be a barrier as well is I find if they don't always advocate for themselves in the same way as their other patients do in the hospital, and then as a result, tend to get ignored.
How about some barriers?
Access, like the follow-up care and medications that mm-hmm. aren't insured, and we don't have a way to send them insurance, especially if they are in the state. Like, my insurance, mm-hmm. or, like, making, I mean, also, like, not understanding, like, culturally, and, like, I had one Somali refugee who had, like, a terrible childhood and, like, witnessed his parents being killed, and with the foster mom, who I don't think really understood, he wasn't acting out because he was a teenager, and, like, it's a terrible situation. He's not understanding where that's coming from.
So a lot of times I like the term literacy when I think about those kind of scenarios and the sense of, like, not only literacy am I able to read, but am I literate about systems? Am I literate about conditions? Or, you know, and the Jen Chapman from the ER and I did a really interesting focus group with a parent talk, the parents there talked about just sort of like, you know, back home, like, those aren't really diagnoses that are made. Like, mental health diagnoses aren't usually made, right? Like, no one really walks around with those kind of concepts, much less that you would ever have anything to do about them, right? Like, you know, so if we can identify that you are depressed, you're anxious, or you have, you know, you have some sort of post-traumatic stress symptoms, like, not only are those not identified, but really, like, what would you do about them if you did identify them, right? So it's sort of helpful. So, yeah, so the, and then anybody else have anything on here?
You know, they're in a desperate situation where they've had a diagnosis that was really devastating and expecting the United States medical system to be able to fix it. And that has been challenging. I think another barrier for the discussion is a little bit of a mistrust in the fact that there's some time, a lot of resources available, which means even with the kids that have been born here and parents are legal immigrants, they don't want to access. Simple things like wigs or snaps because they think they're going to get caught and going to make sure.
If it was really good, why didn't they give it to you?
Exactly.
Anything they're giving away is not good. You know, and there's a reason for some of that distrust in a lot of the places where people come from, right? And so it's a really, it's fascinating. Sometimes I have these conversations and I'm like, no, really, spend your money on something else. All right. What about countries of origin?
I think we often forget China, Vietnam, those numbers are dwindling, but those are the major ones.
Which one do you think is the largest group?
In D.C. or?
In D.C. Human trafficking. Yeah. I had a recent family separation and reunification, which was a lot of the driving force behind a lot of the unaccompanied minors that we're seeing, and then again, education. So wanted to touch base on some common health problems in refugee and immigrant kids. You guys know this because you see these kids every day, all right? What we have found is, so for a lot of these issues, right, so for infections, and there are going to be specific things to think about, diarrheal parasitic, you know, all the families coming, whenever the kids have diarrhea, whenever the kids have abdominal pain, it all wants some sort of medicine for parasites, right? So that's what you do at home, right? And so trying to convince them that they've been in the U.S. the last 3 years, like, this is not something we usually see, you know, they don't have to worry about the light bulb. But so infections, vaccine delays, certainly sexual health concerns, especially with the amount of violence and rape that is experienced on in migration, malnutrition, developmental delay, mental health, obesity. I want to touch a little bit on the mental health piece because that's sort of where we see a lot of the kids, especially a lot of the unaccompanied minors. I would say mental health and then developmental school concerns are huge. And those don't always come up when we are attending to their acute medical problems, which is why it's so important that these kids have a medical home. Because if they don't have a medical home, we never get to those. And those are huge factors. And when we see the kids, even the kids that have been here for however many years and now they're in high school, if we're not tending to the stress and their anxiety around some of their social concerns, then we're never going to really be able to help them. We're not going to be able to keep them in school. We see higher and higher pregnancy rates. We see a lot of violence in kids joining sort of gangs. We don't feel like they have another option. These gangs have also migrated here. You know, and so these are things that definitely we're not always going to be able to take care of on the inpatient side, but we can hopefully at least try to address them. But certainly in the outpatient setting, we want to try to promote some sort of medical home. Right? So what can you do? And I'm going to talk a little bit about advocacy, specifically around this population, but also just sort of advocacy in general. Okay. And the number one thing I want to sort of say is when you advocate for children, immigrant children are part of the largest circle of children. So whatever you're doing to your advocacy efforts for children in general, you're also doing for all these kids as well. Because I recognize that this may be my passion, but it may not be the next person. But we're not at odds with each other. So if your passion is you want to get TIP passed, then please get TIP passed, right? We need people to do that, right? As much as we need people to do immigrant health, and we need people to do, you know, lead, and we need people to do dental. Like there's a lot of work for everybody to do, right? And so the number one thing though is that I'm not being funny when I say this, be a good doctor. You guys went to medical school. You guys are being trained. What we bring to the table that nobody else at this table of advocacy brings is our skills as a healthcare provider. And so it behooves us to sort of think through our differentials, learn as much as we can, keep up with your reading, keep up with articles, keep up with you know, sort of standards of care, right? What happens specifically sometimes in these communities due to some access issues and sometimes due to some language issues is they don't always get the best choices for medical homes, right? So be a really good doctor and then make yourself available, all right? And sometimes that's your corner of the advocacy. And I don't say that lightly. I'm not trying to like get you out of having to do extra stuff, all right? But I truly feel that, you know, that's our number one job, okay, as a doctor. And then find your passion. Because if you're passionate about something, it won't seem like you're doing the extra work. You're just doing it. It's part of who you are, it's part of your being, right? And it's what you tend to read about, and it tends to be what you sort of engage your friends in conversation about. And before we can really be an effective advocate, we need to teach ourselves, right? And we need to teach each other. And so whatever experiences we have that we've learned, okay, I want you to try to share, okay? And that leads to fitting your advocacy into your regular day work. The reality is we all have really busy lives, and if you don't somehow find a way to sort of incorporate it into what you're already doing, it's not going to happen, right? And so if you identify little things in your work day that you think would make the lives of your patients and families easier, then work on that, right? It's going to be so much easier to work on that than to go find some, you know, some other topics that may look really, really interesting, but really how are you going to fit that into your work hard, right? But that makes us all sort of much more effective advocates, I think. And then find your people. This cannot be overstated, right? We all do things because we like the people we do them. All right? I thought I wanted to do internal medicine because of my really great residents that attended my third year of medical school. And then I did an internship and I'm like, wow, no, I'm at it. So I was like, what about my people, right? And so I'm not being answered, right? So we need internists. I'm really glad somebody wants to do internal medicine. So find your people and just make sure that you're sort of getting a lot of energy from them. I know Landre and I belong to a group of people who work a lot on some immigrant health issues, and it's pretty motivating, right? Like, I always sort of feel after our meeting, we're like I'm all going to call on the way home, I have all these ideas, and then trick to act on it really quickly before we lose the energy. And then more specifically, just sort of about immigrant health. On the individual level, listen. A lot of these folks have had experiences, and it's going to take them a while to be able to share them. And if you can be the person that they sort of interpret, or they sort of feel is just listening, the first time it may just be they're listening about their goals, but eventually they'll start sharing their stories, right? And sharing their stories is their first step in starting to feel like they belong to this new place where they are, right? And just to respect where people come. And so when they want their antiparasitic medication, I don't completely blow them up. I acknowledge why they're asking for it. We even talk about it. Like, I know back home, that kind of thing, right? And then provide resources, and there's lots of resources. And then systems, just to request and develop protocols, sort of educate, adopt some standards. And then there's lots of, and I'm going to show you the toolkit in a second, but there's lots of opportunities both on a local, regional, national, even international level. The AAP has an immigrant health SIG. It's really easy to belong to. You go on there, you sign up, and it's on their webpage if you search for it. And you will immediately be on the listserv, and you get like daily unseen, however many. Like, you can read as much of it as you want. Just this morning there was another email about some child in your gallbladder surgery who was detained at the border. And so just sort of sometimes it's just sharing stories, and other times sort of seeking resources. Locally, we have the DCAAP has a immigrant health subcommittee, and we meet monthly over at the Adams Morgan site. And so, what I know that a couple of you have attended this different times, and so would love to have you guys, join us if you like. And you can email me, you can email Andre, those of you who know Dan Newman, you can email him as well. But email any of us if you're interested, and we'll put you in touch and sign you up. And you can do as much or as little as you can. Like, this isn't like, people come and go, and it's very sort of cross-disciplinary group is one of the neat things about it, and lots of different opportunities for advocacy. This is the toolkit. And the AAP, the National AAP, has a toolkit that they put together a few years ago in response to some of the surge of the finance company miners are showing up on the board. And then what we did as and this was actually happening before I joined the group, and then I started joining midstream. But what was done essentially is that the national toolkit was taken and basically modified to a local level, which is great. So that what we can do is if you open any one of these sections of the toolkit. Anyway, any one of these sections, so the clinical and newly arrived laboratory checklist, this in clinic is going to be your most useful thing. You go right here, you sort, and you can print this out if you scroll down. Right over there, you can print this section. And so a lot of times what I do is I just print it out. It's my little, basically, algorithm for what I need to do with the child while they're present in front of me, because a lot of times, as you know, you're going to be the first person seeing this child as far as a medical provider in the U.S. Okay, sometimes they will have been seen depending on where they were picked up perhaps in their migration. But a lot of times the child just arrives and you're the first person to see them, and so you're going to want to go ahead and this is all based on CDC red book. Right? So if you go down, okay. So I'm going to open one of these other sections just for you to know. in each of these sections, you can look for these topics. There's really good information. A lot of it, obviously, for immigrant health. If you want to learn about the education benefits in D.C. for all the kids, regardless of whether they're immigrants or not, go into this section. It's great information in here, right? And it talks all about what's available, what's not available in D.C. and how you access it. And then if you, for the legal services and then for mental health services, there's not divided into D.C., Virginia, Maryland. So I just wanted to show it to you so you know what it looks like. Here's the, if you just sort of go ahead and, where's the address? Right there.
Yeah.
The AAPDC.org and then class toolkit. You can get to it from the D.C. AAP website. I've actually saved it as one of my favorite things on it, and I've used it a number of times. And,
it's mobile friendly too.
Yeah. And so the other thing I think is really important for us to do is for us to get more familiar with what our rights are as healthcare providers and what the rights of our patients are. There's a number of different organizations and agencies that have Know Your Rights events specifically for patients and their families. The National Immigration Law Center is a phenomenal group here in DC. They also have they put on a number of seminars. They also put on a number of events for families. And they have a lot of material online. You can also get on their listserv, and they also will send you a lot of information. The one I'm going to highlight, because I don't have enough time to go over all of it, but is avoid collecting and documenting immigration status. Right. We should not be collecting that information for the point of documenting. I often have asked that information. I then tell them, as I ask it or before I ask it, I will tell families, I'm not doing anything with this information. I'm not going to write it down anywhere. I'm not. I just want to know so that as I take care of you and your family, I recognize what we have access to and what we don't. So that when I'm seeing a newborn and it's a 3-year-old is running around the room, I'm pretty sure it's autism, but doesn't have health insurance. You know, I need to figure out his documents. I need to figure out his status so I can know what I'm going to be able to get. But I'm not documenting it anywhere in this way, all right? But there's all sorts of information around, you know, what to do if someone from ICE or immigration comes and proves a lot to do. What I want you all to know is that the hospital and our clinics need to develop strategies, and the message to you guys should be that if anybody were to approach you about that kind of thing, that there'd be a contact person. I don't pretend that you guys are going to know the ins and outs of all of this, but that we should at least know that this is a topic, this is something we're worried about, and we're developing strategies, and there's someone in the clinic that I can go to if I get that question or come up with that situation.
Right. Can I say really quickly about that? So the one bottom line for you guys is that if I were to come into the clinic or the hospital, there's an email that came out a couple of months now to the whole hospital. Says, like, tell your supervisor and the supervisor should call legal. So whoever your supervisor is, if wherever you are, you know, you're attending or whomever, there's the clinic manager, and that person needs to call the legal department so that we are protecting our patients, protecting, you know, following HIPAA, you know, all of those things, aside from the whole ethics of letting, you know, authorities put into the hospital or into the clinic. But the key there is to tell your supervisor, and if that person calls legal, and legal will take care of it from there.
And we can maybe send out that email again, now that we've been talking about it for your question. The rest of these slides truly are here for your purpose and reference. This basically highlights that DC is only one of six jurisdictions in the country that actually provide insurance purchases for undocumented. And it has some information as a post article about the sanctuary cities. And this was a general article about making a case for sanctuary hospitals. There is just some information that you can look at in articles that you can go to. And then some information at the end around DACA, just because there's been so much in the news around DACA. So stay tuned, I'm sure you guys will cover it a little bit. All right.
Thank you. So at the end, just to tell you ways that you can be more involved if you want. So I know I went over this last time, but again, if you want to know, if you want a good way to know what's going on in the news, I really recommend you become a key contact of the AAP Federal Affairs Office. They generally don't send more than one email per day unless it's really bad. And they'll give you ways to call your congressman, get involved, and what the current issues involving pediatric public health are. The special interest group that Ed mentioned is here at the bottom, including the email for the woman on how to get into
you guys obviously have a lot of opportunity, and we've talked about it before, but take advantage of the fact that obviously your residents are going to be you. That's not something that everybody else gets to experience, maybe residents feel for. So there's lots and lots of organizations, including AAP, that help you sort of figure out where to go so you can get access.
Tonight, the section of pediatric trainees is hosting a training session at that 8 p.m. our time, 7 p.m. Central Time. You can sign up for it right now. They sent out an email about this, but I will be listening in. So, join me. There's also a free conference at Howard this weekend if anyone wants to go on human trafficking. And I'm happy to send you that information as well. So a couple things. Really quickly, these pins, there's one in every resident mailbox. So since we had a small group today, please let your resident peers know that there's a pin waiting for them in their mailbox. They were designed by a pediatrician in collaboration with students at in a high school in Burlington, Vermont, and the goal is to just champion a message of inclusivity so that residents can, residents of the United States can start recognizing it's the symbol of something for that we are welcoming into our clinic. These are, this will be in the PowerPoint, but references for providers and patients on their right for ICE. This is the toolkit. And then lastly, the registration is now open for the AP Legislative Conference. It takes place in April every year. I went last year. It was fantastic. They generally have scholarships so that they'll pay for your tuition fees. Those I haven't seen out yet, but look out for those from the AP because those give you $250 to go to the conference. If you want to learn more about refugees, these are some books that I really recommend. I just finished this one. It's 100 pages. Anyone can read 100 pages. I'm happy to lend it out. It's fantastic. It's written by a woman from Mexico who was a translator for children in the courts in New York. And then if you haven't read The Spirit Catches When You Fall Down, it's a very good example of cross-cultural care and where things get lost in translation. And then these two are about children migrating from Central America. Sonia Nazar is an Argentine, by the way. And then a couple important articles that have been out in pediatrics include, and this is just a slightly older piece that was done on the AP policy statement for the detention of immigrant children. Stuff about vaccines, if you want to learn more about how to talk to your patients about that, since that's also a current issue. And lastly, the sanctuary hospitals, and an interesting article on child abuse currently published in JAMA. These are just NPR, and again, Sonia Nazario is talking about her experience, but this is a documentary that was done about Syria and the Syrian refugee crisis, if that's something that you're interested in learning more. It was nominated for an Academy Award last year for the best short documentary. And this is how I'm going to end with the wise words of Jack Donaghy. I heard this, I was rewatching There You Are recently. So we are an immigrant nation, the first generation works their fingers to the bone, making things the next generation goes to college and innovates new ideas. The third generation no more than takes in prop classes. Thanks for coming, guys. I know it's a busy week. Yeah.
And by the way, it's El Salvador, Ethiopia, China, Mexico.
Oh.
Or the top